The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, it's Cole Swindell. After I give everything I've got to land a perfect vocal, I usually take five before jumping into the next track. And I've learned exactly how to recharge in that time. Some folks grab coffee. I hit a quick good luck spin. Next thing you know, the break is just as fun as laying down the track. A better break makes for a better take. Need a break? Let's chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus TNCs apply. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, we have touched on geopolitics a number of times, but we have never had the benefit of a proper geopolitics and analyst like Firas here. Firas Moudad.
Thank you
very much for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you are a geopolitics analyst.
Yes.
How does that work? Because I've not met too many of those.
So the idea is to help clients understand the commercial impact of risk. Mm-hmm. We want not just to opine on Putin good, Putin bad. Right. We want to tell them what is actually happening in the competition between global empires. Mm-hmm. How the competition is playing out, what are the intentions of the different sides, what are their capabilities, and matching those together in order to come up with a forecast. And from that forecast, we tie it to a commercial impact, such as there are more risks to aircraft in the air, or there is going to be attacks on shipping, or there is going to be explosions, et cetera, or contracts are getting canceled, or what have you. The key part here is truly understanding intent. And you do that by trying to get into the heads of the people that you are analyzing. So for me, I feel that I've matured in this industry by working very hard on understanding a group like Islamic State, taking their ideology seriously, taking what they believe seriously, accepting that they genuinely believe it, and having adopted their mindset, trying to understand what they're trying to achieve, and then analyzing the means at their disposal for achieving that. And I do that for Russia, the United States, China, any country really that is an interesting player that clients have an interest in.
But essentially, you're paid by commercial firms to do this, and yes, they are wanting to understand not what the headlines are telling them,
quite,
but what the real risk is, so that they can make, yes, the right investment decisions, or know if they should pull out of certain markets or invest more in certain markets or whatever. They want to understand the genuine risk rate.
Yes.
So that then begs the question of how often and how egregiously does it vary? Does the reality of a set of risks vary with the narrative that we are being told in the press?
The two are completely divorced from each other. There is no connection between the two. Take Iraq as an example. There are areas of Iraq that are actually quite safe for doing business from a physical perspective. From a political perspective, getting enmeshed with the Iraqi government is its own set of nightmares. Mm-hmm. But from a physical perspective, there are areas in Iraq where the security risks are really not that high. There are other regions of Iraq where really you don't want to touch it with a 12-foot barge pole. So it's about being able to speak to people at the right level of Zoom. The narrower it gets, the more you can give them details on specifically this location and this asset. What are the risks? What are the problems that they're facing? And how does it affect them? And then you can speak to them at a country level, and then you can speak to them at a regional level. What are the different factors in Iraq? Which part of Iraq are the Turks trying to take? which parts of Iraq will the Iranians never compromise about? Where do the Americans fit into that picture? And what about the Chinese and Russian assets? What are the risks to them? So it's about being able to get specific on the locations that the client is interested in. And it's about being able to understand the big picture and tell them how this is likely to change.
I see. So this makes a lot of sense. So if I'm an oil company and I'm thinking about investing in a relatively safe bit of Iraq, my return profile on the investment needs to be more or less normal. Whereas if it's in a disputed bit, the return needs to be significantly higher to justify the risk. That's kind of the way they think about it.
That's part of it. Although that then goes into the way the Iraqis do oil contracts, which is different from most.
Right.
So,
yes.
The political aspect of it and the security aspect of it are two different conversations completely.
Mm.
And both affect the commercial outcome.
Okay, and the thing that I'm intrigued about here now is, so you provide this real analysis to corporations.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, right, the political narrative that goes around, which you say is completely divorced from reality, it appears that the politicians actually believe it, but they actually smoke their own ganja. So when you're presenting this stuff to the C-suite of various corporations, are they sufficiently able to detach themselves from the narrative that they're getting every time they go home and turn on the TV or pick up a newspaper to the reports that you're giving them? Are they able to distinguish in their mind quite clearly the two?
Most of them are. I mean, it's something that you acquire over time. I think in many instances, the politicians really stopped believing that they could make Iraq into a democracy. Hmm. And there was acceptance that this is a competition with the Iranians over who gets what within Iraq.
Is it possible I'm being unfair to the politicians? Is it possible that they...
I think the more
they
senior
know that everything
they are,
coming out their mouth is rubbish, but they're just putting on a show?
There is an element of that. I mean, we don't know how much Tony Blair and co. knew about the Iraq war and about the weapons of mass destruction. Mm-hmm. We don't know how much they genuinely believed and how much they genuinely lied. There is an element of them believing their own shtick. I find that the local level personnel tend to have a good detailed knowledge of the ground. But even with them, you find the degree of idealism that is quite divorced from reality. So you will find embassy staff who are genuinely committed to democratizing Iraq or Syria or Lebanon or what have you, with that having no relevance to what actually goes on the ground and how the country works. You also find them having very intimate knowledge of the various players and their loyalties. And one wonders at how much is there of cognitive dissonance and how much are they just deceiving themselves and lying outright to them, to their audiences.
Okay, so I can understand that the public needs to be sold a narrative. I get that. And it's probably, if you're sending troops over there, it's probably quite helpful if they fully believe it as well, because it's much more convincing to send a young man out to fight for democracy than it is for, you know, we want oil contracts or whatever it is, or
yes,
we're in a geopolitical game with Iran, or whatever the actual reality on the ground is.
Yes.
And I can suppose you can excuse it in embassy staff and so on, as long as they can do the dual trick in your mind that they're talking about the cognitive dissonance and actually get the point job done. But it starts to get extremely dangerous the higher up the chain you go if people actually believe the propaganda version of why something is being done as opposed to the real version. Is that something you see a lot?
It's most dangerous in the context of Russia and China, where you have senior politicians saying that the borders of Ukraine are inviolable, whereas they leave their own borders open. So it's not a question of the viability of borders. There it is clearly a question of imperial competition, which is fair. I don't object to empires. They're just part of nature. They're part of how we organize them ourselves. However, sometimes you need to be a little bit humble and accept that certain geopolitical problems like France or Russia are not going away. and that this is something that you have to live with and manage as opposed to solve.
Mm.
The problem is that in a democracy, telling people that the Russians are a problem that we have to manage doesn't really appeal to people. Whereas telling them either that the Russians are wonderful and we get along extremely well with them, or that the Russians are all evil and they must be destroyed and stopped, that actually appeals to people emotionally. A big Yes. part of the problem that you're trying to put your finger on is that democracy is a highly emotional game. Mm. You really want to be extremely cold when you're thinking about strategy and politics. And getting emotion involved is inherently destructive. This is why the game of politics was always an elite game. With democracy, right. it's been transformed into a spectator sport. The two don't go well together.
That is a good point. That is a good point. Yeah, I mean, it's quite funny. I mean, on Russia, if you look back to, say, the Second World War, we needed Russia, and therefore Stalin was good old Uncle Joe. And he was built up as this sort of friendly, sort of uncle-like character. And then the moment we decided we wanted to turn against him, it flips the other way. And the public seemed to have no problem with this. The public can be moved around quite significantly. And we're obviously in a period at the moment where Russian civilians... I mean, I remember when this Ukraine war started, you had people who were like... I think there was one Russian cellist or something that got thrown out of her apartment in a university simply on the grounds that she was Russian.
Yes.
I had this as well. I mean, I remember when the war started, a mate of mine, we got this group chat, and he was genuinely angry. He's like, what the hell are you angry about? A border dispute. But he had been whipped up into that by the media. So
yes.
So I'm just a bit confused with the whole Russian thing, because it doesn't appear to concern... But it doesn't concern me, as a British. I don't get what the British concern is here.
Look, a lot of the British leadership is still in the mindset where they think that they're still playing the great game. Mm. And they're under the illusion that one day the Russians are going to get to the Gulf and get to India. And this is going to mean that the British Empire is defeated.
Yes.
Absent from their minds is the reality that the British Empire has been utterly destroyed, that Britain herself is being ravaged, that they have no geopolitical relevance. They tried to send one of the two aircraft carriers that they had to do something about the Houthi in Yemen, and they were unable to send the ship. They were unable to do anything. It didn't work. The ship, the carriers that they paid for didn't actually work. So they're under the illusion that they're still in this competition, and they don't notice that now India is a completely autonomous player that's more focused on its own role containing China in partnership with Russia than it is on what the British want. Okay. So they suffer from this delusion of grandeur, and they believe that their role in the world is global and important, when in reality, to the extent that their role is global, it is as a cautionary tale.
Yes. I had wondered that, because... obviously, the great game of the 1800s, where the British Empire tried to contain the various powers to the east, particularly Russia, keep Germany apart
before agreeing to the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which, yes. if implemented in full, would have given the Russians Constantinople and the Straits, the Bosphorus and the Dardanelles Straits, giving it access to the Mediterranean Sea and solving the perennial Russian problem of frozen ports.
Oh, so we must come back to that, the Russian long game. But yes, so the great game played out for a long time, and Britain was good at it.
Yes.
And, I mean, it had a lot of resources and empire and so on. As you say, this has been gradually... And this, for me, has been the... So I'm glad you're saying it. The best explanation I can come up with for the severe Russophobia that this country seems to have, it's that it made sense 150, 200 years ago, and that... has passed down like a genetic memory through the organizations, despite the fact that everything else has changed.
100% true. I would add to that a couple of things. If these people were forced to acknowledge geopolitical reality, they'd have to look at Britain in her current state. If they did that, the only honorable option for them to take would be to go behind the shed with a revolver.
Yes.
And end
That'd be nice, wouldn't it?
So what this belligerence towards Russia allows them to do is to create a highly emotional narrative, which is always necessary in a democratic context, and use it as a distraction. The problem that they're facing is that things have gotten so bad that this kind of petty distraction is an irrelevance. So they will yell at Farage or at whoever that, no, you're a Putin shill, you're a Russian agent, whatever it is. Mainly to distract from the fact that they have categorically failed in doing anything that would allow Britain to have genuine geopolitical influence. So it's not just the memory, it's also the smokescreen. Who cares if the Russians of Odessa or Kharkiv or even Kiev are under Russian rule or under Ukrainian rule? How does this matter? Whereas the price of your house, the degraded services, the problem with migration, the problem with multiculturalism, the safety of your family, these are of immediate concern. But if you were to speak to them, if you were to speak about these issues in the same emotional language that they use about Putin, the reaction from the public would be severe, because they would understand the extent of the betrayal. So it's important for British leaders to stay stuck on this narrative, because the alternative narratives are horrific. Now, for the Europeans, it varies a little bit. For the Poles, there is an immediate threat. If Ukraine collapses, then there is a real risk that the Baltic states would be next, and then the Poles would be on the border with Russia, and that would mean that they have to spend massive amounts on their military, and that would mean that they're vulnerable to the same problem that the Poles have always had, which is simultaneous pressure from the Germans and from the Russians. So I understand Poland's position. I understand Germany's position a lot less. Germany prospers when there's cheap Russian energy and cheap Russian natural resources.
Yes.
Except that the current German leadership is fully bought into the cult of wokeness with everything that that entails, from green energy to collective guilt of the Germans replacing original sin to the whole mess around sexuality and transgenderism, basically making gender identity into a substitute for having a soul. You have something within you that is eternal, that is not seen, that is different from your physical being, except that it's not a soul from God, it's just gender identity. You know? They have their eschatology around climate change, and they're fully bought into that cult. Putin is, in a sense, the antithesis of that. He loves Russia, and he says so. He prays in a church. Whether or not he believes is a different matter, but he prays in a church.
Yeah, he makes sure that he's seen doing so.
He makes sure that he's seen doing so. He's proud of Russian history. He's genuinely attached to Russian symbols and wants the public to be attached to them. He's not on board with the gender insanity. And he's obviously not on board with green energy, given Russia's location. You can't really build solar farms in Russia. That would be stupid. And you can't build wind farms because they'd freeze. And given Russian exports. So in a sense, he is the perfect demon for them, because he is the...
Well, he's everything they're not.
Exactly. He's the antithesis of the woke religion that they've adopted. Now, perhaps a more sane perspective would say, these are ethnically similar fellow Christian nations. Maybe we can cooperate with them, because there's a much bigger economic threat and political threat that's coming from China. But sanity doesn't prevail here. Extreme emotion does.
So there's a whole bunch of things I want to pick up on, but I'd just pull the thread a bit more on the World War III thing. So, I mean, obviously Starmer had an extremely rough start to his premiership, the Southport riots, because people were not happy that children were being brutally stabbed and hacked apart. it really, I don't think a prime minister could have had a worse start than the start he had. So you're suggesting that this, because he really is selling the idea that we actually could be going into World War III soon. He's pushing the idea that young men in this country could be getting conscripted and sent off to the Ukrainian front. In your mind, what is the likelihood of any of that actually happening? Or is it just this smokescreen? Because if we're talking about that, we're not talking about his other failings.
Let's talk about a couple of things here. First problem is conscription. Britain's always had a volunteer army pretty much until World War I. Why do you need to conscript people? Because the numbers in the military aren't enough. Because people have been cutting military spending and reducing the number of soldiers for a very long time. And yet recruitment is low. Why is recruitment low? Recruitment is low because people fight for God and country. That's what they fight for.
Yes.
You're telling them there is no God and that the country is an economic zone, not a people. Real flesh and blood with a heritage.
That the king of this country might believe in a God, but it's not the Christian God.
I don't want to get into that.
Yes.
Because it's not my job to get into what he believes about his personal relationship with God. That's not my place, you know? But I can see why you say that. And I'm very sympathetic to that point of view. However, this is a government that's been saying, we don't do God. And that's been attached to this idea that, no, even though the king is the head of the Church of England, everything about this country must be secular, and not just secular, anti-Christian.
Yes.
Because they're very pro-Muslim when it suits them, you know?
Yeah. I mean, at this point, secular would be an upgrade.
Secular would be an upgrade at this stage, yeah. Yes, quite. And they don't have any national feeling. They don't have any sense that a nation is a family of families. That a nation is tied together by blood, which has always been in the human mind, which is the most natural way of understanding your own community. You're somehow related to them by blood. They reject both of these ideas. Therefore, they must have conscription. They can't build a volunteer army because the kind of people who would volunteer to fight for Britain are the kinds of people that they would call far right. So they have a fundamental ideological problem.
Well, except I think they've pushed them away as well, because they've been so clear that that anybody who they call far right, which would be basically somebody like me, they've been so clear that we are not part of the club, and that we know that if we're gone, all that happened is you know, tens of thousands more boat people will turn up and be praying around our families while we're gone. You know, at this point, I'd just say, put me in prison if you must, but I'm not going.
This is the problem that they have. You need to develop some level of nationalist feeling, if only because you need it in war, and yeah. You never know when war comes.
Well, you need a ready supply of white boys to die in your wars.
Well, not just white boys. In any country, the Indians need some patriotic feeling to fight for India.
Mm.
The Chinese need patriotic feeling to fight for China.
Well, the British government needs them.
For the government, yeah. For the British government, they're obviously not going to be conscripting the people who are in hotels. They're obviously not going to be doing that, because odds are they'd switch sides.
Yes.
You know? So, for them to be able to fight a war, they need to develop a sense of loyalty towards God and country. Much more importantly, you need industry. You need manufacturing. This country's manufacturing is collapsing. Steel mills are closing. Everything to do with heavy industry is falling apart. Why? Because they're committed to net zero. The key to prosperity, first and foremost, is cheap energy. If you have cheap energy, you can handle expensive labor, you can handle expensive other resources, you can handle the rest of it. But the bedrock is cheap energy.
I've always said the base layer of any economy is energy and agriculture. Because if you've got those two, then you can do anything else.
If you've got cheap food and cheap energy, yeah. Everything else is solved.
Which makes Germany, as you were saying, all the more baffling, because they went all in on cheap Russian energy. They built an economy that was a 4 trillion euro economy based on $50 billion of cheap Russian gas.
Yes.
They closed down their nuclear power stations, were totally committed to this, then switch that off, then watch the Americans bomb their energy infrastructure, and said not a damn thing about it. So it's, yeah. It's but no, I will just pull you back on the. So how likely is it that my audience is going to get conscripted and sent off to the Ukraine?
The government will be overthrown before that happens.
Right.
If they try to sort of force people to go and fight for Ukraine.
Do you think they're actually mad enough to try?
Look, the guys in the military think in a very different way from the politicians. They will tell you over the course of a campaign against the Russians, we're going to need this many artillery shells, this many tanks, this many planes. The attrition rate will be such. And this is what you will need to supply us with if you want this thing to last more than a week. Can you provide this? And the answer is always going to be no, because of our ideological opposition to cheap energy and to patriotism.
Hmm.
So they can't, in fact, do it. I wonder if they're coming to a point where they realize that there is a mismatch between what they think they can do and what they can do in reality. Trump illustrated this perfectly. If you remember in his press conference with Keir Starmer, he looked at him and asks him, well, you can take Russia on your own, can't you?
And then everybody laughed.
And everybody laughed.
Yes.
And Keir almost passed out. Because he knows that this is completely unrealistic.
Ooh.
Macron knows that this is unrealistic. And this is before getting into things like communications, electronic warfare, being able to stand up to Russia in electronic warfare, which they probably cannot do. Their dependence on American satellites for targeting.
Yes.
Their dependence on the Americans for everything to do with the F-35. Without the Americans supplying them with software upgrades, spare parts, electronic warfare support, et cetera, they can't do anything.
Yes, and the Russians have spent the last 2 years getting a masterclass degree in electronic warfare and drone warfare.
Yes.
And we're seriously behind on that.
Extremely behind. And the soldiers aren't trained for it and they aren't motivated for it. Mm. And meanwhile, we have the Royal Air Force saying we have too many white men.
Yeah, and we've only got 80,000 troops, and that includes the pastry chefs, and God knows how many of those are actually fighting fit.
Look, British Special Forces are excellent.
Yeah, but there's not enough of them.
But there is nowhere near enough of them, yeah. And you can't fight a war with them.
So do you think that, because we've watched this pantomime over the last couple of weeks of European leaders getting together and explaining how they're going to spend a lot more money on defence. Now, they do it in such a way as to imply that this money that they're spending on defence will then promptly be used against Russia. It could just be that they're cycling money around the European defence stocks. And that is as far as the game goes.
It's not just that. It's that, firstly, where are they going to get the energy for this? If they are going to go to the Gulf and try to get it from the Muslim world, these will be much harsher towards them than the Russians ever will be. Remember, the Russians really didn't want a problem with Europe.
Hmm.
They lashed out in 2008 over Georgia, and then in 2014 over Ukraine because there was a coup in Ukraine against the duly elected government.
Well, I think that Putin has quasi belle. I think he has a good one as well.
There are very reasonable reasons for this. Look, there's something that we should remember. There is George Kennan, the architect of containment. Henry Kissinger. There is nothing nice to be said about Henry Kissinger, but he's brilliant.
Well, he was bloody clever.
Exactly. He was brilliant. Noam Chomsky, on the opposite extreme, completely divorced from all of this. And then Samuel Huntington. These men agreed that the West getting involved in Ukraine would trigger a Russian war in Ukraine. This was known. This was understood. Nobody who was serious disputed it.
I believe the former US ambassador to Russia wrote a paper several years ago saying if we carry on down the current path, it will force Russia into a war.
I think it was Burns who said that. It was William Burns. So this was very much understood by Western decision makers. But an element of the Americans thought that they could do to Russia what they have done to Europe. Europe is in the following situation. Every time there's a military issue, the Americans need to get involved. Even bombing Gaddafi in Libya, the French and the British needed the Americans to do the refueling and to do the targeting and to do the logistics and to do all kinds of other things in support. Obama yes. called this leading from behind.
Well, I mean,
they were leading.
If Europe can't bomb something in North Africa from Europe, I mean, what the hell can it do?
Exactly. So in terms of defense, Europe's condition is hopeless. In terms of economics, whenever there is a financial crisis, the Federal Reserve has to bail out the European Central Bank, the Bank of England, the Swedish Central Bank, the Swiss, etc., etc. If you are not autonomous in the management of your own economic markets, and you're not autonomous in your own defense, what right have you got to claim sovereignty?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is something I was going to throw to you at the end, but I'll bring it up now. To my mind, certainly Britain and most of Europe are simply vassal states of the United States. Would you disagree on that?
No. I would add a couple. I would add a couple of points. They are uppity vassals, prone to lecturing their imperial master, and this is why the Americans are switching sides. The Americans under Trump have figured out something that is going to be a very big problem for the Europeans. They figured out that they're better off with a full economic partnership with Russia. So when Trump says, we want to have excellent relations with Russia, we want to be able to invest in Russia, etc., etc., what's he doing?
What does he mean by that?
Okay, so let's pause for a second and take a step back. The recklessness of American leaders from Clinton through Biden, including elements of Trump 1, led to a situation where the Iranians, the Chinese, and the Russians are locked into an alliance. Not because they like each other or trust each other. Remember, the Russians one time sold the Iranians faulty centrifuges for their nuclear program. The Chinese and the Russians really don't look very highly at Iran. Whenever Iran is under sanctions, the Chinese do their best to milk Iran for every last penny they can get. But it was American pressure that pushed them together. The result, essentially, is a configuration that can dominate Eurasia. Because you have Russian resources, but also Iranian and therefore the rest of Central Asian resources going to China at a discount.
That's something I've talked about a fair bit, which is Russia has energy and commodities. Bad capital, bad demographics, bad technology. China has technology. It has decent resources, poor energy, demographic profile looking bad.
Yes.
So those two are pretty strong. But then you combine the monsoon region or Southeast Asia. That solves your entire demographic issue. If you move capital, energy and resources around those three, you know, we're gonna take Russian energy and we're going to take Chinese know-how and capital and we're going to stick a massive factory doing something base level here in Cambodia or India or something, ship the resources back up as they move up the value chain. You've basically got a power block that easily beats, or at least will soon easily beat, US and Europe.
Yes.
And if I was in charge, my whole game plan, if I was on this side, would be making sure that that alliance never comes together.
Which is what Trump is working on.
But they've done the precise opposite. They've pushed them together.
Their recklessness, their arrogance, has made them believe that everybody naturally wants to follow them and that everybody should. They don't understand this configuration. Now, on the demographic side, I just add a note that the demographics are not interchangeable. But aside from that,
I don't think they would move people around. I think they would move products around.
Exactly. Yep. In terms of market size, yep. This is a massive killer market. And if you force these countries together, you leave the Japanese and the South Koreans with no options.
Oh, yeah, they're going to have to do it.
They're going to have to side with the Chinese and with the Russians. So what Trump is trying to do is to break this configuration. The only way to do it is a full partnership with Russia. and to give the Russians what the Chinese cannot offer.
Okay, this is interesting. I hadn't heard this before.
The only way to do it is to give the Russians what the Chinese couldn't offer them, which is a fair deal and a bit of respect. China doesn't have allies. This is something that has to be understood. The Chinese don't have allies because they look at everybody else and they think, you're all a bunch of upstarts.
I mean, their entire worldview for the last, 3,000 years has been that we're on top and everyone else is, yeah.
Exactly. The Middle Kingdom means the center of the world kingdom. Okay? So if there is a full economic partnership with Russia, if all of the sanctions are lifted, and American industry can take as much of Russia's natural resources as it wants, et cetera, on better terms than the Chinese are willing to offer, with, in some cases, better technology and a better cultural fit, then you have a behemoth that naturally dominates Central Asia because of Russia's role and the economic power. And Europe, hold on, equally importantly, it means that the Russians are a partner of the South Koreans and the Japanese in working with the Americans to contain China.
Right.
So drawing closer to Russia, aligning with Russia, is a huge geopolitical prize, especially if you accept realism. If you accept that there's no way that Russia is going to be a liberal democracy, because a liberal democratic Russia survives for a grand total of one generation. That's it. And then it breaks apart. Moscow must be an imperial capital.
If you'd like to see the full version of this premium video, please head over to lotuseaters.com and subscribe to gain full access to all of our premium content.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
Menards' 11% rebate is here. From lighting to lumber, from doors to floors. The bigger the project, the bigger the rebate. From painting projects to that new kitchen makeover and designing that outdoor space of your dreams. Save big on any project you're tackling. Hurry into Menards for an 11% rebate on everything. Mail-in rebate is a merchandise credit check, not a point-of-sale discount. Redeemable on future in-store purchases only. Not on future purchases on Menards.com. See store for details.
Save big money.